Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? We recently saw a video he made and it was shocking. He's in his 80s and still kicking butt, working out, staying active, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife tried too, and she says she feels 10 years younger. Her body looks leaner and she has energy all day. With the stress of everyday life, on top of the toll all the world's terrible news takes on us, it's more important than ever to stay healthy. My Morning Kick is the way to do it. Chuck made a video that explains everything. Make sure you watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/useful. It'll change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/useful. You won't believe how simple it is.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a prophet in the new novel, American Prophet. I prophesied a natural disaster, a pandemic, and that crazy election. Now there are conspiracies about me. A dude is shooting at me, and the president is threatening me. My story is on Amazon, Audible, and Apple Books. Check it out. Just look for American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer. That's American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm your second host, Aaron Matte. And remember that our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com, where you can go to support the show, get bonus content, including the extended interview with this week's guest, Norman Finkelstein.
And of course, you also get Thursday Throwdown, which is your midweek dose of media madness. And in addition to those rewards, you're just supporting this great show. So what's not to love about that opportunity? You're welcome.
Huge opportunities to support independent media.
Yeah.
And thank you for being here with us. We have so much to get to this week. Should we start with our four basic food groups?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. For Democrats Suck, there's always a plethora of material when it comes to the Biden administration's complicity in the genocide in Gaza. But because we're focusing on that with our interview this week with Norman Finkelstein, we'll take a look at some other areas where Democrats suck. But of course, not taking away from the fact that the foremost area is their complicity in genocide. But let's take a look at Kamala Harris, who took a trip to Puerto Rico and was greeted by some protesters who she thought were actually welcoming her, serenading her with like some local music. And so watch what happens when she finds out that actually the people chanting are not celebrating her, they're protesting her. So for our audio audience, what you see there is Kamala Harris clapping along to the chant and the rhythm until her aide tells her that she's being protested, and after that, her clap slowly comes to an end.
Yeah. And what they're saying is, we want to know, what did you come for? We want to know, what do you think of the colony?
Yeah. And they're telling Kamala Harris that she is a colonial master coming to the colony, right. and they're protesting her, and hence the hand clapping stops.
That must have been very disappointing for her.
Yeah, most people in life don't have to worry about discriminately dancing and clapping. You can just clap to any beat that you like. But with Kamala Harris, you have to watch your back, because sometimes the rhythm is protesting you.
Sometimes the rhythm is going to get you.
There you go.
Not like Gloria
Estefan.
Estefan said.
Yes.
Yeah. But in a much more nefarious way.
Mm-hmm.
The rhythm is going to get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it came for Kamala. So speaking of Kamala, Kamala and Joe Biden are now claiming that they're staunch advocates of healthcare for everybody. So check out this tweet that they just put out. It says this: point of view, you believe healthcare should be a right, not a privilege in America. And as our producer, Matt Wilson, pointed out, there's kind of like a fake selfie, the way Biden has his arm extended. They want you to think it's a selfie, but it's really not. This is like a staffer taking a picture and they're pretending they're taking a selfie.
Right. They're like, Biden, put your arm out. Pretend you're taking a selfie.
Exactly. Which makes this picture all the more of a joke because, of course, the idea that these two think that healthcare is a right and not a privilege is undermined by their entire record, including Joe Biden famously vowing to veto a bill for Medicare for All if it ever reached his desk. This is Joe Biden during the 2020 campaign.
It comes to your desk. Do you veto it?
I would veto anything that delays providing the security and the certainty of health care being available now. If they got that through and by some miracle, and there was an epiphany that occurred, and some miracle occurred that said, okay, it's passed, then...
If an epiphany occurred where people actually believe that healthcare is a right, not a privilege. The epiphany that he claims to now uphold, which he actually doesn't, as he's explaining here.
Yeah. And you got to look at the cost. I want to know, how did they find the $35 trillion? What is that doing? Is it going to significantly raise taxes on the middle class? Which it will. What's going to happen?
So there it is. He, when asked what he would do if a Medicare for All bill came to his desk, he said he would veto it because it's too expensive, because how could we pay for it? Well, one idea is to not funnel all this money into the Pentagon, raise taxes on the wealthy. There's so many things you could do to actually fund healthcare rather than the current system of bankrupting people who can't afford it. But Joe Biden doesn't want that. And hence why his selfie, his fake selfie, is also a fake promise. It's a fake pledge.
Fake selfie, fake message.
Yes.
Fake news.
Yes, 100%.
All righty. Well, let's move on to Republicans Suck. Let's take a look at this clip of friend of show, Lindsey Graham, talking to Netanyahu, his good friend, his good pal, Netanyahu.
I'm here also to take on, and I will talk about this tomorrow, a form of blood libel in 2024, that the state of Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. That is bullshit. And I will tomorrow walk through the food that's coming into Gaza and what you're doing to make sure that people in Gaza do not starve. So Israel is got its back against the wall. We have your back.
So Lindsey Graham, by the way, gets about $1 million from AIPAC, just a point of information. But also he's claiming that the claim that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war is bullshit. He's really taking off the gloves there. And I think that I'm going to go with, I'm torn, but we have on the one hand, Lindsey Graham and the government of Israel, the notoriously dishonest government of Israel, saying there isn't starvation. And on the other hand, you have Human Rights Watch, the EU foreign policy chief, a report from the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, Professor Nick Minard, a senior surgeon from Oxford University Hospital, and the emergency medical team's clinical lead in Gaza, who's saying we are seeing children and adults in the hospital with serious malnutrition. So after much consideration, I'm going to say that it's actually Lindsey Graham who is spouting bullshit.
Lindsey Graham is so committed to having Israel's back as it's up against the wall that not only is he lying through his teeth about its blockage of aid, but look how close he gets to Netanyahu. Let's go back to that clip for a second. They're very close together. Look at that. They're just very, very close. And like Graham's the getting his face.
Yeah, he is.
Graham's getting his face. He's telling him how much he's with them. So, you know, Graham's certainly committed to genocide. He's making that very, very clear.
He's also willing to curse for the cause.
Yes, he's cursing for the cause.
And he's a Southern gentleman, so that takes a lot. Actually, he's cursed on live television, too. I think this is a new Lindsey.
Okay, for isn't that weird, we have a novel form of protesting our current presidential field, which comes down to right now. We have Donald Trump, Joe Biden, or who's in third place? RFK Jr., I guess?
Probably, I think.
Who just announced a billionaire or a very, very rich person is going to be his running mate, someone who gave a lot of money to his campaign. Nicole Shanahan, who's married to the co-founder of Google. Anyway, somebody in Texas, a man in Texas, is not happy with our current field. So he's going so far as to change his name and get into the race. He's changing his name to literally anybody else. That's right. A Texas man says he isn't satisfied with Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And accordingly, he's changed his name to literally anybody else.
That's an isn't that weird slash isn't that inspiring. I like it.
I mean, speaking of sacrifice, we're talking about Lindsey Graham.
Right.
For, you know, putting on the line for genocide. Literally anybody else is literally changing his legal name just to protest our lack of adequate choices.
It's his website says literally anybody else isn't a person. It's a rally cry.
So, but where does anybody go? Is anybody in his first name or is it his last name?
Oh, like, it's a good question.
Is
right.
Is he Mr. Anybody Else or is he just Mr. Else?
Right. Is it anybody else, comma, literally? Like, is it maybe his first name is, hi, my name's literally. Literally anybody else.
Yeah.
Mr. Anybody Else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or is it one thing like share, but three letters, but like a mono name?
Mm. Is that legal? Can you change your name just to one name?
I think
name?
Madonna did it, right? Cher. Wow. But I don't know. Maybe that's not their legal. Those aren't their legal names. That's a good question. I wonder if they did change it. You know, he has a good bio for running. Maybe he should really run as a person, not just an idea. He's a 35-year-old U.S. Army veteran and 7th grade math teacher.
Wow. Yeah, that ticks a lot of boxes right there.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
He served the country in more ways than one.
Yeah.
And he has a really interesting name.
And he could crunch a budget with those math skills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I need that, yeah.
Well, Mr. Else or Mr. Anybody Else or whatever your name is, we salute you for protesting our two-party system and for your creative approach to politics. So, you know, and also just for becoming an entry on Useful Idiots. Isn't that weird? That's a feat in itself.
That's kind of the biggest achievement. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So for Isn't That Terrible, let's take a look at a counter-protest. You have counter-protesters with Israeli flags who are protesting against pro-Palestinian protesters. And listen to what they're chanting.
What's your credit score?
What's your credit score?
What's your credit score? What's your credit score?
So they're chanting, what's your credit score, which is implying that they're lowlifes, right? They're basically saying you're too poor and irresponsible to receive a loan. And this is a taunt from people very concerned about anti-Semitism.
Truly, I think that's the lamest counter-protest chant I've ever heard. What's your credit score?
It's so bad.
Yeah. Does anybody think that a credit score is like a significant measure of a human being and their place in life? I mean, that's just, it's
these people
really
do.
These people obviously do. Yeah. Truly. Yeah. If there were words for lamest, like counter protest chant, I mean, that's gotta be up there. What's your,
I wonder if they're actually pro-Palestinian plants trying to look like disgusting people. Cause that would be good. That would be a good, they would have done a good job, but sadly I think these, people are so out of touch and morally bankrupt and such disgusting snobs. And it really, again, these are people claiming to care about anti-Semitism. Do they think this is a good look for Jews to be obsessed with credit scores?
It's really embarrassing. You know, there's something so obnoxious too about this country, like Israel. You know, getting all this money, all this U.S. taxpayer money, billions of dollars per year to commit mass murder, and then the people who support this policy have the gall to brag about like credit scores as if they're like fiscally responsible people, when really they're living actually off of U.S. taxpayers. They're living off of the welfare state being so generous in supplying Israel with weapons and the support it needs to commit genocide and apartheid.
Yeah.
So many layers of lame in this one.
So many layers. A lame layerocracy. Yeah, indeed. And those are your four basic food groups. We are so excited to be bringing back onto the show Norman Finkelstein, political scientist, who has written several books, including The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. And most recently, I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, Heretical Thoughts and Identity Politics, Cancel Culture, and Academic Freedom. He also is the son of two Holocaust survivors.
Very excited to hear from Norman once again. So let's go to it. This is Norman Finkelstein. Norman Finkelstein, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to start by asking you your response to the UN Security Council resolution that was recently passed. For the first time since this genocide began, the U.S. did not veto a measure calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, but immediately the U.S. declared that it was non-binding. and therefore their policy had not changed, as John Kirby put it. What did you make of this resolution?
The resolution itself, I would say, I would not personally make a big deal about whether it said a lasting ceasefire or a permanent ceasefire. A permanent ceasefire obviously is to some extent a contradiction in terms, because how could you predict that a ceasefire is going to be permanent, as in until eternity? So I don't think that's, in my opinion, that wasn't a significant issue. I have to confess, I don't even think whether lasting or permanent is particularly significant for the following reason. Anybody is going to accept that, let's say there's a large scale provocation, that it would justify on the Israeli side a resumption of hostilities. And it's very easy for Israel to fabricate that kind of incident that would, you know, quote unquote, a terror attack, which turns out 10 years later to have been masterminded or orchestrated by Israel. So inasmuch as any large incident would justify in the eyes of the public the breakdown of the violation or the ceasing of the ceasefire, even that didn't seem to be important in my mind, whether it's a permanent ceasefire or a lasting ceasefire. There's always provocations that could justify, quote unquote, breaking the ceasefire. As to its consequences, international law is a strange bird, because in law, as you know, on any case, like I've been involved in the most trivial cases, I sued my telephone company because they were constantly charging me these late fees, which I thought were a scam. You go into court. I went to small claims courts, the lowest level, right, where you get to defend yourself. They go through literally hundreds of precedents in order to decide whether or not I had a legitimate case under so-and-so statute. In international law, there's so little law. There's such a small body of law that they inevitably rely not on case law, but what are called publicists or experts in the field. Now, because the United States has so many lawyers, they can always find an expert who will tell you A is not A, night is day, and so on and so forth. So now they've come up with a legion of lawyers to prove that Security Council resolutions are not necessarily binding. The technical term is it was passed under Chapter 6 and not Chapter 7. Chapter 7 refers to the articles in the UN Charter talking about enforcement of UN Security Council resolutions. So now they came up with a new idea. It's pushed by the US and the UK that not all Security Council resolutions are binding. However, the consensus in the international community is the Security Council resolution states the current law on the subject. So for example, UN Resolution 242, that famous UN resolution on the Israel-Palestine conflict, it was not passed under Chapter 7. But everybody agrees that is the standing law on the topic or on the issue. That's why everybody refers to 242. Nobody says 242 is non-binding. Everybody accepts that is the statement of the law. So I was watching closely because I know these so-called controversies in international law. And I was watching closely how the Times was writing it up. Right after the vote, the New York Times said, binding international law, end of story. Later, it started to say, Security Council resolutions are the authoritative statement of the law and stayed away from the question of whether or not they were binding because of what the U.S. rep said. We consider this non-binding and they're not going to contradict the U.S. government, which is all a long way of saying these are technical questions and de facto, I doubt they have any real significance unless the United States goes along with trying to enforce the resolution. And that wasn't going to happen whether it was binding or not.
It's also interesting that the ceasefire, as you mentioned, perhaps it's not that significant whether it says permanent or lasting, but this doesn't even pretend to have any durability past Ramadan.
Yes, I heard one very intelligent and passionate Palestinian from Gaza who was very articulate in English. I heard her express extreme anger at the resolution on two grounds. First of all, it's just 2 weeks before Ramadan is over. And second of all, and I have to say she was very convincing, she said, Israel has taken 7,000 Palestinians prisoner since October 7th. And she said, what about our hostages? What about the 7,000 people who were randomly rounded up and are now in prison and are being tortured? And there was an argument there. But obviously, there was very, very little room for maneuver by Hamas. Because they could hardly be seen to be defying the Security Council. That's not a prudent move at this point in time. So they declared it a victory, whereas it's kind of a hollow victory.
What do you think accounts for the U.S. decision to let this one pass rather than veto it, as it usually does? Do you think that just is chalked up to the fact that it recognized it was non-binding and toothless?
No. First of all, these occasionally happen. My memory is, and my memory could be faulty on this, so I want to acknowledge it. The last time it happened was in November 2016, where, as you know, President Obama had the most consistent record of any U.S. president of voting of vetoing every resolution coming up against Israel. Along comes November 2016, remember, 1 month before his office is over. It was a very funny story. As you know, Mr. Obama is a stupefying narcissist. So why did he do that? He has only 1 month in office after he has the record of being the most pro-Israel president in modern American history. The $30 billion 10-year arms deal, arms support for Israel, the veto, why did he do it? He did it for two reasons. Number one, because all he's concerned about his memoir, and he wants to show in his memoir he was balanced. So when Israel sometimes does bad things and then we have to abstain from a resolution criticizing it. So he needed that resolution to show his balance and not that he was a complete and total flunky for Israel. And the second reason was perfectly obvious. Obama's a stupefying narcissist and he's very thin-skinned. He wanted to get back at Netanyahu. He didn't want to do it during his term, so he does it at the end of his term because of what Prime Minister Netanyahu did by barging into Congress during the Iran negotiations with Iran, which, by the way, was a kind of funny thing because Netanyahu expressed outrage at an American president interfering in internal Israeli affairs and calling for a new election, meaning a call by Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Your classmate.
Right. Well, he attended the same high school, but earlier, forgetting what he did by barging into Congress, leaving aside the whole AIPAC issue, but just on a symbolic level. What happened here? Actually, I think it's an important lesson, especially for young people. And the lesson is, it's a long battle. You can't expect instant results. So let me go back to one precedent, which I remember quite vividly. It was the build-up to the war in Iraq. And as you recall, or you guys may not be old enough to remember, but if you're old enough, though the opposition to the war in Iraq in 2003, it was the largest demonstrations in world history, largest anti-war demonstrations in world history. And
we were old enough to attend. I attended. I assume you did too, okay. Aaron. Yeah.
Many people, young people, they concluded in despair that here are the largest anti-war demonstrations in world history, and nonetheless, the Cheney-Rumsfeld administration goes ahead with the war in Iraq. And that, to me, is, with no offense intended, it's a naive understanding of how formidable, concentrated the power we're up against is. It's a very long battle. Now, of course, that offers very little solace or consolation in the middle of a genocide, that before we accomplish anything, large numbers of people are going to be killed. However, I do believe that Biden, because of the accumulation from different angles, the accumulation of pressure on him. There's the international pressure. There's the domestic pressure. There's the institutional pressure coming from places like the International Court of Justice. Those pressures, which you can't calculate with a, with a device, they gradually accumulate and accumulate and accumulate until they reach the proverbial critical mass and have a real political impact. You're not going to see it, you know? You're not going to see the connection between the demonstration in Grand Central Station on so-and-so date and that abstention in the UN Security Council. You can't connect it with a straight arrow line or a beeline, but it's there. It's there. And so we should always remember not to despair, and that even though many people will perish before there is the connection between your little demonstration in your town square and action by an act of power, there is a connection. Unfortunately, it takes a long time because you're up against institutions of fantastical power and concentration. It's tough. It was not what we wanted, and we still don't know if anything will come of it. But the other side is, if you do nothing, you can be certain nothing will happen. There's possibility that it will be a payoff for someone. It's obviously not a payoff for those who are dead.
There's also a more cynical reading of this, which is that by not vetoing it, the U.S. prevented the resolution from being brought to the General Assembly, where there's a more of a democratic voting system. Because had they vetoed it, that would have been the next step. And by abstaining, it now stays where it is. And it's they're presenting it or calling it, as we've just discussed, non-binding, only for 2 weeks. And now the Biden administration may be able to claim credit for calling for a ceasefire without actually doing anything with any teeth.
Yes, except the obvious problem with that argument is a General Assembly resolution is technically just a recommendation. And so it couldn't have any teeth. This one, because it's a Security Council resolution and for most of the world is binding, except the US and the UK, this one at least has the potential of going somewhere. Look, the bottom line is, I will repeat myself, it's a long battle, and these are steps along the road. It's no consolation for those who are suffering and those who are going to die. But each move, the one by the ICJ, the Security Council resolution, they are steps along the way, and they are in many ways imperceptible. I was struck when I was reading Frederick Douglass's speech commemorating John Brown. And you could say, well, John Brown's raid was a failure. He ended up being executed. And Douglass says, yes, that's true. That's true. That's true. But then he said at the end, I wish I could get it if you like. At the end, he said, but there's a straight arrow line from John Brown's insurrection to the Civil War. And in the end, John Brown was victorious. Now, at the time, who would have seen a straight arrow line between what he did and the Civil War? And it is an irony worth savoring that John Brown was tried and convicted for treason. And yet, 1 year into the Civil War, what were the Union troops singing? They were singing, John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave. That was the Union song. So what seemed like a complete failure as an action, to overturn slavery ends up not only prefiguring it, the Civil War, but also transforming or transmuting a person executed for treason and reviled for his treason into becoming the hero of the Civil War.
So the U.S. not vetoing this resolution has played into this sort of media narrative that there's now a rift between Biden and Netanyahu. And after the resolution passed, Netanyahu very loudly canceled an Israeli delegation's visit to the U.S. They were going to come to the U.S. to consult with the White House about their plans to attack Rafah, and Netanyahu canceled that. What do you make of that claim that there's a rift now between Biden and Netanyahu, which also comes after Chuck Schumer gave this widely hyped speech calling for new elections in Israel to basically replace Netanyahu?
If you recall, I'm always candid about predicting errors on my part so as to convey the fact that you can study a topic for a very long time and still be fallible. I had said all along that I did not believe Biden would allow the war to drag into the new year. I was speaking in November and December, that the new year was going to be the cutoff and that Biden was going to pull the plug on Netanyahu, because I did not believe he was going to jeopardize the presidential election with supporting Israel's genocide in Gaza. I was wrong. I was off by a solid 3 months, which is not trivial. But clearly what Biden is doing is because of two kinds of pressure, as I said. There's the international pressure and there is the domestic pressure. And the domestic pressure is the impending presidential election and the fact that critical constituencies for Biden are outraged by the U.S. enabling of the genocide in Gaza. So, in my opinion, Biden's reaction is the resultant of the two forces, the international pressures and also the domestic pressure. In the same way, Netanyahu, his reaction is a resultant of the, in my opinion, the domestic pressures in Israel, because Netanyahu domestically, he thrives on showing his defiance for the United States. That's his, so to speak, shtick, that he is standing up to the U.S., which plays to the whole of Israeli society. It ought not to be forgotten that 90% of Israelis, according to the most recent polls, either believe that Israel is using enough force, that's about 50%, and 40% believe Israel is using insufficient force in Gaza. There's only 10% who think, hey, you know, we're going a little bit over the top with this genocide. And so when Netanyahu defies the United States, that plays well with his domestic audience. I would say that of all the recent events, the most interesting was the speech by Senator Chuck Schumer. It wasn't brilliantly written. It's not Abraham Lincoln, for sure. It's probably above George Bush. But it, frankly, in terms of the crafting of the prose, not much better. But the and he's a very smart guy, so I guess that's he's just playing to the expectations of the American public in terms of language. But it was a very interesting speech. I read it belatedly, thinking, all right, Schumer and Israel, there are things that I can think of other topics that interest me. But it was an interesting speech because it spoke to the dramatic shift in public opinion. And just to give you a couple of examples. First of all, he was very careful in his balance when he was allocating responsibility for the horrors currently unfolding. He said there are four obstacles to resolving this conflict. One, of course, Hamas. Two, the head of the Palestinian Authority. Okay? Then he said, on the other side, there is Benjamin Netanyahu and the far-right people like Veer and Smotrich. So Chuck Schumer is saying the responsibility falls on both sides equally. Now, you have to remember, Chuck Schumer was the most pro-Israel senator in the United States. During the Iran negotiations, he and Bob Menendez were the only two Democratic senior senators who voted against it. At the time, Dianne Feinstein, she supported the deal with Iran. It was Schumer and Menendez. So you're talking about, and you know, Schumer likes to say, my name Schumer comes from Shomer, which is the Hebrew for night watchman, watching over Israel. And he was always, he was a complete fanatic. I mean, in 2010, he said that Israel should economically strangle Gaza. That's what he said to a room of rabbis, Orthodox rabbis. Israel should economically strangle Gaza, which is a nice thing to say about a population, one half of which is children, that you should strangle them. In any event, so it's the same Charles Schumer who now allocates culpability exactly evenly between Israel and the, between Israel and the Palestinian leadership. Secondly, as you know, to describe Israel as a settler colonial state that's considered an anti-Semitic outrage in formal public opinion. Guess what? Schumer says, well, many people call Israel a settler state. And he distances himself from it, says, you know, Jews have wanted, you know, next year in Jerusalem for 3,000 years in the whole shtick. But he doesn't outright dismiss it as anti-Semitic. He suddenly has to explain why he disagrees with that opinion. And then the question comes up in his speech of one state. And this was, to me, the most interesting part. As you know, according to even the IHRA definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism, one of its so-called examples of anti-Semitism is denying Jews the right to self-determination and a Jewish state, that whole thing. He didn't go that route. He did not. What he did was patiently explain why, in his view, one state was not a good idea. And he began by saying, very interesting, he began by saying, there are many young people in their idealism who believe in one state. And he was not going to gainsay their idealism. He didn't say in their anti-Semitism want one state. In their idealism, they want one state. And then he gave the usual arguments about why he didn't think. But now, the important thing is the legitimation of notions like settler state, the legitimation of notions like one state, and the fact that Schumer had to contend with them as legitimate points of disagreement, as in, we'll just have to agree to disagree. Now, why did he do that? Two reasons. One, there's obviously a restive, if not outraged, base in the Democratic Party who believes in those notions, settler colonial state, one state. He's got to appease them. He's not going to agree with them, but he has to acknowledge now the legitimacy of those positions. The second, pure speculation. I know nothing about the guy, nothing whatsoever, except his reputation when I attended high school. And even though he was 3 years ahead of me, his reputation endured, even in my years. Brilliant fellow. He has two daughters. They're about 30-something and one is 40. Of course, they both attended Harvard. That goes without saying. One of them is a lesbian, and each year you see him photographed with his daughter at the gay pride parade. And it's a close-knit family that you could see from afar. You know, he's a typical... that generation Jew, and there's a close-knittedness. And I think it was he realized, beyond the political side, a lot of his daughter's friends probably support one state, you know, or think Israel, well, there's some aspects of this which are racist, you know, the Israeli state. And I think that he realized just from his conversations with the new generation that it's impossible any longer to use those old epithets, you know, anti-Semitic, Jew-hating, or self-hating Jew, that would mean all of his daughter's friends who support these ideas are anti-Semitic. And that's a very offensive thing to say about your daughter's friends. So I think there was also the aspect of him being, because he has those two daughters, him being attuned to the sensibilities of the new generation. So I thought it was, if we can use the term, at an ideological level, it was a watershed. It was a recognition that ideas, notions, which were not just taboo, but outrages, even just 3 years ago, have now been, I'm not saying they are the dominant ideology, but they have been normalized. They have been normalized or legitimated. And that's another way of saying that Israel, for the first time, is confronting on a global scale a legitimation crisis. Because up until, from 1967 on, the question of Israel's legitimacy as a Jewish state was no longer in question. I'm talking about the mainstream. I'm not talking about pockets of the left. The only issue was the occupation, the illegitimacy of the occupation. But UN Resolution 242 is very clear. Israel is a state in the region. As a state in the region under international law, you have to acknowledge its legitimacy as a state under international law. That's UN Resolution 242. No ifs, ands, or buts. Now, for the first time, its legitimacy as a state, not the occupation, but what the Schumer speech marked, more by way of not breaking new ground, but reflecting the balance of forces in our society and also globally, is Israel's legitimacy as a state has been called into question. And there was another indication of that. As you know, both of you know, the primary example for all one state advocates has been South Africa. South Africa represents the one state option, as in, why can't Israel and the Palestinians be like the blacks and whites in South Africa? It was very indicative that it was South Africa that took up the cause of Palestine. And if you had any doubt about its significance, when the foreign minister has been interviewed, and she's been doing a huge number of interviews, when the foreign minister is interviewed, she says, of course we support the Palestinians. Our cause and their cause is the same cause. Well, if our cause and their cause is the same cause, that must mean the same outcome or objective or goal. Now, it is true, because I don't want to overstate the case. I don't want to exaggerate the case. Formally, South Africa still calls for a two-state settlement. You can see it in all of its formal statements. But if you look at the internal logic of their position, they say our struggle and their struggle, it's the same struggle. Well, then, as I said, it calls into question whether, if it's the same struggle, whether two states or one state is the logical outcome if they're the same struggle. So a lot of things, look, politics is 99% an unpredictable game. And you never know what's going to be the result of an action. So everybody said, oh, what did Hamas do on October 7th? It was a complete disaster. It set back the cause of Palestine. I was on a panel the other day, three weeks ago, with this fellow named Dan Lazar. You might know him. And he's saying it was a catastrophe, it was a disaster, it was the worst disaster in Palestinian history. And nobody's going to deny, you know, the death is just overwhelming. The destruction, this Gaza's been turned into a parking lot, you know? Nobody's going to deny that. But politics is unpredictable. There have been significant changes at many levels, but one being the level of public opinion since October 7th. Now you ask, was it worth it? I have to tell you, guys, you know, whenever I say something like this, I have this super ego that says, what would Chomsky say? What would Chomsky say? Because that's how I function for a large part of my life, or what, for better or for worse. I know he would probably disagree with what I have to say. And that is, yes, there are predictable outcomes, and the predictable outcomes are horrible, then you don't do it. But sometimes the unpredictable outcomes, I believe, are more significant. Allow me one more example, two more examples. You take the case of Nat Turner's Rebellion. So around 61 whites are killed, okay? As a result, about 120 then plus others who were legally killed, 200 blacks were randomly killed, heads severed, put on stakes, okay? Horrible. So you say, what Nat Turner did was crazy. Look what he did. What good came of it? Then new laws were enacted. Nat Turner was highly literate, apparently by all accounts, a brilliant fellow, white and black accounts, a brilliant fellow. So they ban any reading of books. You know, you can't educate a black person. Then they ban any congregation of blacks together, because Nat Turner had, under the guise of giving religious sermons to these other folks, was actually laying plans for the revolt. So at a level of death, what good came of that? 200 black people were randomly killed. At the level of law, a complete disaster for blacks. Now they can't read and they can't even congregate. If you saw two black people congregating together, arrested, okay? But then John Brown says, I was inspired by Nat Turner. And Frederick Douglass says, there's a straight arrow line from John Brown to the Civil War, and Civil War and slavery. So if we connect the dots, it all starts with Nat Turner. Now, I'm not going to support or not support what Hamas did on October 7th. I'm simply going to say that politics is an unpredictable game. Now, it's an enormous amount of death and destruction. No question about that. And there, but for the grace of God, go I. I could be the child buried beneath the rubble in Gaza. And I'm not going to trivialize that. I think that's, if we can call it a secular sin, to trivialize the death and destruction in the name of the cause. No, I'm just speaking as a factual matter. Significant things have changed since October 7th.
Norman, we wanted to get your response to a new clip from Bernie Sanders, where he's talking about the Israel of today, led by this, you know, extremist far-right government of Netanyahu. And what he's saying is that this is sort of unprecedented for Israel, that Israel of old was something different than what we're seeing today under Netanyahu. And he specifically mentions the former Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. So this is what Bernie Sanders said.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Okay, you want to hear a joke, Norman?
It depends.
All right. So a Jewish guy marries a Native American woman, and his mother disowns him. And they don't speak for years. And then years pass by, and the son calls the mom and says, look, I know you disowned me, but I thought you'd want to know that you're now a grandmother. We had a child. And don't worry, we gave it a Jewish name, Whitefish.
No, that wasn't that was an unexpected joke. Yeah. I have to say, whoever came up with that, that's true cleverness.
It's good, right? You know,
Bob Hope, who you might remember, no, yeah. Comedian?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay. So he was a horror story, by the way. He was in this ultra-right during the war in Vietnam. I think everybody wanted to throttle him. In any event, he used to pay anybody who came up with an original joke. An original joke, he would give $1 million.
Wow.
So I think
how could you track down, though? Like, I guess it was harder to...
Yeah, you couldn't Google it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
But that joke that you just told me, that's an original.
Yeah, it's good, right? My uncle told me. My uncle has had a lot of great jokes.
Aaron, did you hear this joke?
I did not. No, tell me.
Okay, so don't worry. We gave the kid a Jewish name. Whitefish.
That's good. That's pretty good. Good,
right?
Oh, come on, Aaron. That's an excellent joke.
It's pretty good. Yeah. No, it's good.
You have no idea what Whitefish is.
And to hear that full interview with Norman Finkelstein, where he comments on Bernie Sanders' recent somewhat problematic comments about how the Israel today is different from the Israel of Golda Meir, you can go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Yes, and if you go there, you support the show and get plenty of bonus content, including the extended version of today's interview with Norman Finkelstein. Also, the Thursday Throwdown. It's a great time. Please go there if you can.
Thank you. Bye, guys. See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.